The following program is brought to you by Podcast One. Recorded live backstage, this is Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. And now, we bring you the 2017 Geffen Playhouse Unscripted Year in Review.
We have an unusual guest today, somebody who is very close to the Geffen Playhouse. And if he doesn't like this interview, I guess technically could fire me. We'll find out.
Oh, my gosh, no. Definitely
pressure's
not.
On for me. Matt Shackman is the new artistic director of the Geffen Playhouse. Matt, welcome to your own podcast, I guess, sort of.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So we talk to actors about how they go about getting jobs, how they audition, how they try out, how they read, how they have their callbacks. How does somebody get a job as an artistic director? Do you come in and say, here's what I want to do. Here's how I'm going to shake the plays up. What is the process like?
It is an interesting process. Yeah, I've directed three plays at the Geffen, so I know the theater pretty well. I've loved working there. And when they started their search for a new artistic director, I was really happy to throw my hat in the ring. And then you go through a lot of meetings with the board. They have a search committee. And you try to articulate your hopes and dreams for the institution and how you would go about trying to bring those into reality.
So how do you work with an actor who, for whatever reason, can't figure out the reading that's going to work in the performance?
Well, first of all, I'm very humble because I was a lousy actor,
okay,
or I was a mediocre actor. So I am always in awe of actors and what they can do. And I feel it's same with great designers. It's the same with playwrights, that you come at something with what you think the story should be, what the moment should be, and you allow the actor to process that through the filter of their own talent. And they're going to come up with something far better than whatever kind of line reading might be floating around in my head. So I avoid it like the plague. I would never tell an actor how to say something. I usually find what's more important, especially in theater, unlike film and TV, where you do a few takes and then it's done. It's frozen in time. And then later in the editing room, I'm putting it together. Theater, you want all of the members of your acting company to fully own the world of the play. And that's not just what's happening blocking or moment to moment in the performance, but they need to own the tone, the style, everything that's happening on stage. It needs to repeat relatively in a cohesive way from night to night when a director is not around. So you need to build that from the ground up. And if you're coming from the outside in, telling them this is the way the music of this line is, you're never going to get something that's special and that stays special from night to night.
As you're thinking about the kinds of things that you want to do, is it a question of that appeals to me at this point in my career? Obviously, the nature of the roles are going to change because you're not 25 anymore. The nature of what you're going to be offered is going to change because of that. But does your criteria in terms of what you find challenging, what you find satisfying, what you feel you haven't done yet evolve? And does that lead you in different directions than it might have even just 10 years past?
That's a very complicated question. It requires three answers.
Okay.
The first one is yes, things do change and criteria do change over time, obviously. When I was younger, my only criteria was to stay employed. That's the only thing that drove me, was to kind of keep working, keep making a living so I can pay my bills. And I basically said yes to everything. When I became a bit more kind of financially secure, a bit more relaxed, a bit more knowing that I'm feeling more confident that there would be work, I started then thinking in terms of, well, what if I've got a choice between this and this? Because it wasn't until I was well into my 40s that I ever had it was in a situation where I would have a choice between one job or the other. And when that happened, I then would choose something that would appeal to me for whatever reason. Now, I'm back to just saying yes to everything.
Because it all comes around.
Yeah, because basically
you've become Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, they're not writing sort of roles for 64-year-olds like every minute of the day. But the thing is what you do is you embrace where you're at. I mean, I'm ready now to play judges and, sort of quirky dads and granddads. I'm ready for that,
Yeah, but if David Thewlis can play a superhero in Wonder Woman, anything is possible, right?
I guess. But then you have to be as good as David Thewlis.
Ah, who's to say who's better and who's worse?
I was at the end of the 7-year run of Malcolm in the Middle,
What a wonderful experience and a lot of fun. It gave me financial security for my family and wonderful. The very next Saturday, I was at a charity event and I bump into Jason Alexander and he says, I'm directing a play at the Geffen Theater. Are you interested in doing a play? And I went, yes. And he goes, okay, I think it's going to be an interesting play.
Is this God of Hell?
This is God of Hell. And so I just instinctively knew it was the right thing to do. So there you go. You pour into it. It's a professional theater. They do really incredible work. For me as an actor looking at it, it was, this is where I need to go. I need to wash away the Hal kind of sweet Basili dad, like let him settle down where I can still, though, for me, create and be, you know, emote and have some sense of respectability on stage.
I would always see things twice or three times or 10 times or 100 times because I wanted to figure out why I felt what I felt the first time. What brought that feeling to me? You know, I would always kind of let my emotions enjoy whatever kind of ideas or thoughts or feelings the artists on stage or the filmmakers were trying to move me with. And I would get moved and I still get moved, you know, if it's done well. And I'd go back and I'd say, why did I feel that? Why did Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire move me like that? Why is that? Why when I saw the Bob Fosse shows, it was like seeing a movie, but live. It was like seeing Gene Kelly live. And I say, well, what is it? What's the detail that caused all that to happen? And that's what, you know, I would dissect those things, kind of study everything I could to figure out how I could move people with the art form that I was good at, which was magic.
Ask any of my cast members in Book of Mormon, and they will tell you that I am perhaps the worst actor when it comes to forgetting lines. Not only do I go up, but I make an event of going up. There was one time when we were doing the second act and we were doing You're Making Things Up Again, Arnold. And I got distracted by someone who I shall not name, a celebrity in the front row who was texting. And I was really angry. And
not Madonna.
It was not Madonna. It was somebody from the cast of Entourage.
It's Adrian is texting.
I won't say who it was. Can you use the word douche on this podcast?
You can. Yeah. You can use whatever word you want.
Yeah, he was a fucking douche. I'm just going to go for it and say it all. So this unnamed person was texting, and I was really annoyed. And I was trying to come up with, like, an improv to do about how I was going to just bring attention to him and what he was doing. And in the midst of me trying to be cute and do something, not only did I forget what the line was, I forgot the English language. And it was a musical cue. And I could not come up with anything.
So you're speaking
so there's
Esperanto? What is the language you default?
All I hear is like tinnitus. I hear like, and then the conductor, Stephen Aremus, is screaming the line at me. I can't hear.
Do you have an earpiece? How are you hearing it? He's just below you in the pit.
He's below me going, Josh, yeah. And then to my left, the stage manager screaming. And I can't hear anything for whatever reason. And I finally come up with an improv. And this is the improv. What the fuck am I saying? That's what I scream. The audience was so confused. I was so confused. I thought I would be fired not only from Book of Mormon, but from acting.
There is not, if it's a roast where it is untelevised, meaning if, say, we're roasting Donald Trump, which we did at the Friars Club, there were no rules there because it wasn't being televised. However, on his second roast that was televised on Comedy Central, he had a rule which was there's one area you have to stay away from, and that was his bankruptcies. He didn't want to take trips. No lie. And it seemed like there's in the contract for these roasts a few areas. If you don't want to get made fun of about it, they won't mention it. Like, for instance, Pam Anderson, when we roasted her, she didn't want made fun of that she had hepatitis C. And that's this thing. And you almost go, well, you know, they're doing this roast. The money's going to charity. They're not taking it home. You know what? If they're going to get beat up senseless anyway, so let's not beat them up about that. But what you do then, you have the roast anyway, and then you say, excuse me, those jokes about those things anyway, you don't say them there, but you say them afterwards and say, this is what she wouldn't allow. But I get it. I understand it. Hey, if it's me, I probably wouldn't have any rules because I'm really not ashamed of anything. So, but that's, you know, it's just your openness and it depends how people react.
And it was all the losers who didn't go home for Thanksgiving doing this theater of cruelty. And we locked ourselves in a church for about 7 or 8 days. And there was a woman who ran it called Rena Maretska or something like that. And she didn't speak a word of English. And we had bowls of water and we had some oranges and bells and some scarves and drums. And yeah, I don't even know what all this stuff was there for, but that was there. And then sometimes we would walk around in a circle for like an hour. I'm not kidding. And then sometimes we would just see, and most of the time it was about like, let's just see what happens. So we'd just be in the space and we had all these weird props. And then we would just, someone would start beating on a drum and someone would eat half an orange and someone would play with a scarf. And then all of a sudden the dance would happen. And then there would be this kind of physical improv. And it was crazy. I mean, it was like doing acid for a straight week. It was insane. There was no audience or anything like that. It was freezing cold in Boston, and it was nuts, but it was a pretty great experience.
Do you look at it differently? Because maybe you're looking at it as an actor, you're looking at it as an investor and producer. Are there different entry points based on where you see yourselves fitting into the story?
I'm also an actor, so we always look at scripts through the actor's lens. The story itself jumped at us. I mean, the 90-year-old atheist on a spiritual journey, that's tremendous. We all, if they're still around, we all have fathers and grandfathers. If they're still around, if they aren't, we think about them. And that's what really jumped to me about this story. There wasn't a role for me in it. And like Yvonne said, when we went to the reading, this role that wasn't originally on the page got on the page, and it spoke to my wife as an actor and as an actress and as a producer, and it spoke to me too on the investment side too. So that we were coming in because we believed in the story. Actor wise, once that presented itself for Yvonne, it took it to a whole other level.
My like kind of actor rock bottom was actually involved my bottoms, strangely. I was doing an abridged Shakespeare. I was doing an abridged Tempest for children, and the company that was putting this show on was, short of a better way to say, corrupt. They were they were rough. They were really like possibly should be in jail, and so one of the ways that they would get revenue, you know, without paying any of their actors, of course, was to loan us out to birthday parties. And we had the first act figured out, but we had never staged the second act. So we basically went as a company in costume to this very fancy schmancy house, this very fancy birthday party in Soho, and just to do the first act of this abridged Tempest. And basically the whole first part of the party was us just babysitting, was just us, you know, just really talking to the kids, keeping them occupied and hoping that, you know, the sugar crash didn't happen too quickly. And then when it was time for us to perform, we went out on their deck, which was which was unfinished. There was no, like, you know, I don't know what that's called. Is it a polyurethane or something? You know, whatever you put on a deck to make it not splintery, that wasn't put on yet. So I was Ariel, and so I'm a fairy, of course. And so I, right. You know, my entrance is like, you know, some huge leap in onto this deck, you know, here I am. And I totally bite it, totally bite it. I fall because I'm tripping over children and whatever. And we get through the whole thing and we go home. I walk, you know, I'm like praying to God. I'm like, why is this my life? And I go home and my ass just hurts like hell. And my now husband, then fiance, realized, we both realized that I had many, many splinters in my butt. And so, you know, one of the reasons I married this guy is because, you know, when I'm like, you know, bawling, making no money, doing children's abridged Shakespeare, he's literally pulling out all of the splinters from my butt. And we counted 40 splinters. So, wow. Yeah.
So the test of whether or not a boyfriend is going to make a good husband is whether or not he can pull splinters out of your ass. Yeah. Willingly, and also apparently count them.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, I think that was, you know, the scientific cherry on the sundae was he just wanted to know how many. So it's like, well, I got to pull them out to find out.
Can you explain to friends or family how you work as an actor and how you get into a character, Alan?
I find it very hard to do that because, as you
said... To explain it or to get into character?
No, to explain it, okay. You know. I think it's something that, for me, it was a learned behavior over years. If I look back at stuff I did as a 20-year-old, you'd be thinking, what were you... Like, you know, you had a notion. And you kind of... I find that you learn it as you go. As I said, I always look just for a little bit of peace and calm. Really, that's all I need just before I start in any medium, be it film or theater.
But are you somebody who, if you're playing a mathematician, is going to read tons of biographies about maths? Are you going to try Are you going to go really deep and do research and hope that some of that stuff kind of percolates up?
Well, for me, it all changed, actually. I did a play with Mike Lee, and he directed it. And it was the first time he ever came back to a piece of writing, and the play was called Ecstasy, and he'd originally done it in the Hampstead Theatre in the 70s. And with him, the process begins creating a character at a date of birth, and you come up with that together. And for 7 weeks in rehearsals, you create and grow that character from his birth to events that would have affected him in his life, to stories that only he will know, even when other characters come in. And that gives you, when you're on stage, it gives you a backpack, which means you never second-guess your character in any way, shape, or
form. That's unbelievable. I mean, that's the way he makes movies, but I didn't know he worked that way in theater. Yeah. And that's got to be, I mean, that is ownership of a character, isn't it?
It literally, yeah, because, and as you said, you're creating and discovering moments as you go, as the character and not as the actor. Because
right.
You're so immersed in it. And I've always then kept that attitude in relation to all my work since then. And that's been about 10 years ago. So I try to, and that's when you say about research, even doing the imitation game that we did, and that was all based around, you know, the Enigma machine and trying to break it with the first, you know, real computer. Now, I got as far into that as I could without having to actually go into, you know, actual maths that would make your mind melt.
But are you the kind of actor who would come up to Graham Moore, who wrote the Imitation Game, and say, what about this and what happens here? Because he knows that story incredibly well.
Yeah, you would. And then, of course, Graham would go, well, it's interesting. You see
your
that.
Theory is interesting.
Yeah.
But wrong.
Or I don't know as well. And then you go and try and figure it out together. Yeah.
Jennifer, what about you? Not in this play or just broadly speaking, mm-hmm. in terms of trying to build foundation for mm-hmm. a character through research, through long walks mm-hmm. at night, whatever it is that gets you there.
I mean, I'm a homework whore. And I feel like the thing that I took away from theater school that I feel like was the most valuable was this idea that there's a constant inner monologue. So, you know, as Alan is saying, I mean, mine might not be that my backpack is full of a character's entire history, but if I'm describing a photograph as I do in this show, then I do have in mind the photograph that I've actually seen that really fleshes out that moment for me and makes it land for me, because I think it has to land for us if it's going to land for the audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that silences do have to be filled with appropriate thoughts. And I've never been one of those actors who's willing to use my own real life experiences. I think it's exploitative. And I also think it's inappropriate in that if I'm – I mean, I remember having some teachers who would say, you know, it's okay to cry over the loss of your dog when you're five if you're then doing a scene about divorce, which to me makes zero sense. It just takes you out of the present.
Even if the memory of the dog makes you cry,
right,
which makes
it
look like
about
your
the tears.
Right.
My whole thing has always been, and I'm a crybaby, so it's convenient, but my whole thing has always been, if the writing is good enough for me to want to do it and it moves me, then there will be tears. If it does not authentically move me, then the character is not authentically moved, and therefore the character is not crying, for instance, and I'm not going to try to drudge up some personal experience. Though sometimes you have personal experiences that do completely overlap, right. Like if your characters are breaking up and suddenly it reminds you of, oh my gosh, that moment when the world turned upside down and that punch in the gut, I can draw that up, but that's still keeping me in the scene that I'm performing. But I do feel like it's all about that constant subtext, that internal monologue that does have to be, you know, grounded in the world of your characters.
You know, the fun doesn't stop there when it comes to the president's Twitter feed, because the other thing that was sort of startling, and I accidentally made headlines as a result of it, the mayor of San Juan had very strong words for the slowness of aid arriving to Puerto Rico, and the president took the following Saturday morning after the storm to tweet, they've coached the mayor to be nasty to Trump, his third person, not mine, and our guys are doing a great job, but the Puerto Ricans want it all done for themselves. That's a rough paraphrase of what he said. And I'm a little known for how nice I am on Twitter, you guys. I tweet good morning and good night every day. I tweet videos of my son's trains. I tweet slow-mo videos of my dog. I am aware of the way the world is, and I kind of pride myself on being a little corner of the internet where maybe you'll get a nice joke that a kid wrote, or maybe you'll, you know, I don't ignore the world as it is, but I do try to be a break from the rest of social media, which is increasingly toxic, is increasingly divisive. And yet, I have never seen... I've never seen a president attack the victims of a natural disaster before. Who does that? I think that that's one of the – it's a gimme if you're a world leader. A natural disaster is no one's fault. It is an easy way for us to unite and rally behind you. And so I used the only words that were at my disposal at that time, and I sent three or four very negative tweets to the president of the United States. And then I was on the cover of the Daily News. And by the way, that was the strongest spike in fundraising we saw. And that says something to me. We have lots of fuel sources that get us up and through our day. Love is a fuel source. Rage is a fuel source. Joy is a fuel source. They all can power your ship in different ways. I don't like to work from a place of rage. I am in awe of artists who can do it. When I see a piece of work that is full of righteous fury, whether it's a movie or a play, I go, how did they sustain it for long enough to make that? Because I would be a mess. I can only last about three tweets. And yet... I think ordinary people like you and me were so incensed at the president's reaction that fundraising became a way of getting back at him. And I'll take it. And the people of Puerto Rico will take it if that is your fuel source in that moment to give. You know, I write musicals. They take years. It took me 7 years to write In the Heights. It took me 7 years to write Hamilton. So I have to work from a place of love. I can't. Everyone's like, can't wait for your Trump musical. It's not coming. It's not coming from me anyway, because I don't want to be in that headspace for 7 years. I need to love what I write about. But I say all that in response to your question, which is words matter and rhetoric matters. And we have seen over and over again that we have had to yell and scream for this government to do right by us, whether it's screaming for the repeal of the Jones Act. The first response is, we're not repealing it. And then everyone said, it's a 70-year-old law that does nothing, and there are ships in the harbor. And
this is a law that prohibits ships from coming into Puerto Rico.
Right. And you've got this international aid. You've got all these people who want to send aid. And David Benyo from CBS did an amazing report that basically turned the tide on that. He went in front of the ship that had full of supplies that were waiting to go. And he said, this is aid that you sent that isn't getting there because of the Jones Act. And we got a 10-day wave of the Jones Act. I'm doing a march in D.C. this Sunday where we're asking for a permanent repeal of the Jones Act because it's about maritime law in the fucking 20s. 1920s. But again, our rhetoric and our words are making a difference. They actually, you know, so in addition to continuing to donate and keeping things in your thoughts, keeping us in the conversation is equally important because we have seen it turn the tide again and again in reference to the specific disaster. Are
you ready? For people who don't know the practice and studying of acting, especially in school or in an acting class, can be bizarre.
Yeah.
You can see some weird stuff happening in terms of what the teachers are asking the students to do, what the students are doing. And if you think bad theater is bad, bad acting class is a league unto itself.
It's true. But you also don't want to be like a snob or be ironic or like, I'm too cool for this. If you're in the room, you better be committing to what they're asking you to do. So it's that battle of like keeping your intellect away or just committing to whatever they ask you to do. So it is a battle. But there are... The bad acting class is a class where you go and the teacher just tells you, oh, you're amazing. You have that thing. I can't take my eyes off you. And then after 8 weeks, you leave and you're like, I don't think I learned anything. Because there's no like tools or takeaway. They don't teach you how to break it down or how to research.
I spent a lot of money, but yeah. I don't have anything to show for it.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about stand-up and what it's like to succeed at stand-up and, equally important, what it's like to bomb and what that teaches you and how you walk away from that experience as a better performer and with a little more kind of moral stamina to stand up in front of an audience and believe in yourself.
Stand-up's the hardest of all the like art forms I've ever done. So it's really wonderful when you have like a bit or I mostly did characters. Like I would just cook up, like I'll be a clown who was in Vietnam, or I'll be like a, you know, a Rat Pack comedian and dress it up and have props and stuff. So I would always try bits like that. I didn't have like a Seinfeld keen observation type of act. But when you try something and it succeeds, there's nothing more exhilarating. But it's brutal if you get into like the first two supposed laughs and there's nothing and you're committed to like 8 minutes of this character. It's a nightmare. And you're also alone if you're on the road, which I did in the tri-state Illinois area, Wisconsin, Indiana, Michigan. And you get off stage, the comics won't look at you, the guys you're traveling with, and then it's like you're in your hotel room reliving that. So it's a very punishing art form.
I've been so fortunate. Well, certainly, the recently departed Sam Shepard. I was...
Barry Child.
Yes, I did Barry Child, two productions of it. I mean, the same one with some changes, both in the at Steppenwolf in Chicago and then on Broadway. And that was most wonderful. And then some years later, he wrote a play, Heartless, and I ran into him a year, and he said, I'm writing a play with a part for you. And by golly, it turned out to be true. It was a play that was done at the new Signature Theater, when they moved into their new space, which is a wonderful space of three theaters and lots of public room. So I had two terrific times of working with him. And in Buried Child, although I had seen it when it was new many years before and been very, very impressed and by it, Sam wanted to revisit it, and Gary Sinise at Steppenwolf decided to do a production. And Sam was with us in rehearsals, both in Chicago and in New York. And that was wonderful because he had things he wanted to work on. And of course, in Heartless, it was a new play. And he was also there, you know, with us. Horton Foote was a beloved writer, and I loved him very much. and did. I've known him. I knew him actually quite a long time, a little bit through friends and at the Ensemble Studio Theater, which is a developmental theater I've been part of since it began, which I think might have been 1973. I did a one-act play of Horton's there many years ago. But more recently, it's now about, I guess it must be like, how many years ago? Maybe 20 or maybe less. I did a production of The Trip to Bountiful, which I think is of such a beautiful play. And I don't know if I'd ever actually had a better time altogether. I think it was a wonderful production. It was meant a lot to me. Horton was always present and the most wonderful, supportive. He loves actors. He started out as one and then was not wildly successful and also urged to be a writer, so that's what he began to do. I was so struck when we did it. The play was new in 1953. It was a three-act play, and in its first year, it was on a television drama and the Broadway stage, and then it went on a tour. And from then on, so over 50 years, Horton had been, how many productions of that play must he know, plus a wonderful movie, etc. But it was as if there was, couldn't have been more fresh. And at one point in rehearsal, he said, you know, we could do this without an intermission. So he did some cutting, wonderful cutting, and we reduced what had been this great big multi-set. It is multi-set. It has many sets. But rather than being ponderous or stopping to change them, it was designed to move very fluidly. And we did it from beginning to end, and it was just wonderful, a wonderful way to do that play.
Thanks so much for listening to Geffen Playhouse Unscripted from Podcast One this year in 2017. We're so excited to share our upcoming guests with you this year in 2018 and can't wait for you to hear them. In the meantime, please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or the Podcast One app and be sure to share the show with your friends. We'll see you next week for brand new episodes of Geffen Playhouse Unscripted.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at podcastone.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.